In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Words like physics or God or tattoos or dark metal, all these words actually help you. Increasing the probability that you get a reply, it's all very interesting.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of At the Margin. Today we're chatting to Dr. Josue Ortega of Queen's University Belfast. Josue is an expert in matching markets. Matching markets are essentially markets without money. Normally we use prices to allocate goods to those who value them the most. If I'm at an auction and I'm bidding on, say, a car, if I pay more than somebody else is bidding, that means I value it more. That means the car goes to the person who will get the greatest value out of having the car. We're able to allocate goods and resources to those who value them the most. How do we allocate goods and resources to those who value them the most when we don't have prices? Well, that's where matching markets come into play. And they're really interesting. Well, I find them really interesting when it comes to a situation where we have preferences at both sides of the transaction. So if you think about, say, somebody who's going for a job, well, the person, the candidate for the job, they have a preference when it comes to the type of employer or where they want to work. And, you know, the employer has preferences when it comes to who they want to work for them. Another example would be romantic partners, where both individuals have preferences as to who they want to pair up with. And this last point is something that Josue has done a lot of work on, in particular when it comes to online dating. He's looked at what factors result in matching success, or he's at least familiar with that literature, and has done some research himself on how online dating has changed the pattern of matching, particularly with respect to the diversity of romantic couples. So this is a very interesting topic, and hopefully listening to two economists doesn't take the romance out of dating for you. So Josue kicks us off here by telling us exactly what a matching market is.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me now. So matching markets refer to environments that look like markets, but where we cannot just simply use money. For example, if I want to do my PhD at MIT or Harvard, you know, I cannot just buy my place there. My kidneys are not working and I need to receive a kidney to have better life expectancy, I cannot just go to nearest hospital and say, hey, I want to buy a kidney or buy it from somebody on the street. If I want to have a good place for my kid in a good public school, I cannot just buy a place for him or her. They have to apply. And, you know, it's this idea of markets, things that would look like markets, but there's no money involved on them.
Okay, so there's no money involved, and therefore it's a bit like almost like a barter that we have to try and match up people's preferences and, well, not necessarily barter, but that's maybe one specific type.
Yeah, in a sense, like barter, but in some other cases, we have fancier algorithms. For example, if you think of school choice, some algorithms that were used in the US is, for example, you try to assign as many students to their first choice, the school that they say, no, this is my favorite. or there are other algorithms. And yeah, as you mentioned, there are considerations about fairness, there are considerations about efficiency, and very much like a normal market, really. But.
Right. Okay. So no money. It's a lot more complicated, basically. So there are different types of matching markets then. Maybe you can tell us about how this can sort of play out.
There are basically two big types of matching markets. The ones where we try to match people to other people. So, for example, think of it as a marriage market. There's men and women being matched to each other, and we like to understand who gets matched to whom and why, like, what do we search in a romantic partner, in a spouse, in a girlfriend, in a boyfriend, you know? So these are very interesting types of markets. And then we have these kind of other one-sided markets where we try to match people to objects. Say, for example, we try to match students to schools. We try to match, for example, young doctors to hospitals to do their residences. These are the two kind of big problems out there in the literature.
Okay, right. So school choice is probably something a lot of people are familiar with. And that would be where people are in a district and they have children in the household and they want to, the child has to go to school, and people have a preference from school A over school B. And then another household has a preference over school A and school B. And we have to try and allocate the children to the schools in a way that maximizes welfare. Is that the idea?
Yes, exactly, something like that. So, for example, in some places, like most of the UK, I understand, kids are allocated to school just based on geographical distance. You just go to the nearest school based on catchment areas or something like that. However, that brings some problems because, for example, very bright students in poor areas have to go to poor schools, right? And perhaps not so bright students in rich areas go to the nicest public schools. So perhaps there's this new idea of trying to let students express their preference over school so that perhaps, you know, we can let the brighter students go to the best school. So perhaps, you know, there's simply potential for reallocation of students so that everybody's better off. So now in many countries, like, for example, the US, in Hungary, in Chile, and so in France, students are allocated to schools based on their preferences, so they can submit, say, a ranking of schools. It differs depending on each country. You can list 10, 4, or something like that. But you can say, my top priority school is this. The second best is this.
Yeah.
And then students are allocated based on their preferences that are reported.
So you submit a preference, and then somebody has to allocate students based on that preference. And the procedure of doing that allocation, obviously, is quite complicated.
Yeah, there are different procedures. There's something called the BOST mechanism. But the thing that was used in the beginning was to realize that it gives wrong incentives to people. Say, perhaps you want to play safe and not, if you think you don't want to list the top school as your top school because you think you don't have really the best chance to get there. So maybe you don't want a mechanism to give growing incentives to strategize. And then you also want that the outcome of the mechanism or the algorithm is going to be efficient. It's going to be probably going to try to assign as many people to their top choice. It's going to be also stable in the sense that there's no justified envy, that a student that is has not so good grades as me gets assigned to a school that I wanted and I don't get to that school.
Okay, so that's you make a very interesting point there, in that people will try to game the system if they can at all. So you want to make sure that they reveal their true preferences. They don't sort of say, well, if I put this school ahead of this one, that might mean that might lower my chance for maybe option C or some other sort of permutation they might think in their head. So that you want to try and stop that sort of behavior, I suppose.
Yeah, you want to stop it for several reasons. First, it can result in a completely different allocation than the one that you would obtain if people would just reveal their real preferences. Second, because if the mechanism can be played by the smarter parents or the most strategic parents, then you are not leveling the playing field because, you know, the people that really think about this, they know exactly how to manipulate the system to get to the better schools.
Okay, so you have to be careful about how you decide to make sure people are incentivized to reveal the truth. And so have you any examples of maybe a mechanism that on paper, like on face value, you think, okay, this is efficient, but actually there's a perverse incentive there. And maybe is there a mechanism that actually works?
Yeah, sure. So for example, the so-called Boston mechanism is called Boston mechanism. So in that mechanism, you just try to assign as many people to their first choice and as many people to the second choice and so on and so on.
Yeah.
So this mechanism has very perverse incentives because it's not in your best interest to say MIT or Queens is my best choice, because perhaps that will harm the chance to get to my second best. Perhaps there's not enough applications to my second best. And if I just say the second best is the first, I will get assigned there for sure. Whereas if I say my first is my first, there's a chance I don't get there and I will end up further down on my preference list.
Yeah.
So there's other mechanism that there's available and it's actually used in many countries in the world, called the fair acceptance, proposed by Nobel Prize laureates Lloyd Shapley and David Gale, that it does something a bit different in the sense that there's a sequence of proposals and rejections, but you can guarantee that this mechanism produces an allocation that is in a sense fair and also does not give incentives to misrepresent preferences.
And how does that that procedure work?
So say students propose to the most desired school. The school tentatively accepts the proposals and rejects anything that they cannot accommodate. Those rejected students now propose to the second best school, and that school may reject some of their applicants that they were already accepted until it fills the quota. And those students that were rejected keep proposing. And okay, we have this kind of cycle.
There isn't that same interaction between your first preference and your second preference like there would be the other mechanism. Is that sort of what's happening here? It's breaking the link.
Yeah, it's never a better idea to apply to the second best first, because the application to the first does not have any effect on the second one.
So that's sort of school matching. But so one interesting one is kidney matching. How does that work, essentially?
It works as follows. So suppose you need a kidney and your brother wants to give one to you. And I also need a kidney and my girlfriend wants to give one to me. But perhaps my girlfriend were not blood compatible or antibody compatible. And therefore, she cannot give a kidney to me and I have to be on the waiting list until forever. Same problem with you. You need a kidney. Your brother wants to give one to you, but you are not compatible. So what is kidney exchange? Well, your brother is going to give, perhaps your brother is compatible with me and my girlfriend is compatible with you. And perhaps my girlfriend can give the kidney to you and your brother can give the kidney to me. In practice, sometimes kidney exchange can happen in a much bigger scale. There can be, instead of just two pairs, three pairs, four pairs, and so on.
So a normal market would use prices to try and allocate these things, whereas we don't have that in kidneys. It's illegal in many cases to buy kidneys.
Actually, in Iran, it's not. It's the only country where I know it. You can just go ahead and buy a kidney.
And okay, so another thing that I want to talk about is, and you've done a bit of work on this, is in terms of online dating. So matching markets and online dating, maybe you can help us bridge the link here. What can matching markets help us? How can they help us to understand online dating?
Economists like to think of marriage sometimes as a market, because there are clear traits that we can estimate how much women prefer this in a man or how much men prefer this in a woman. For example, we know very much how having an extra degree of education helps you both in terms of marriage and in terms of online dating. And so there are few papers studying online dating. I think it's very interesting because online dating now is the most common way to meet your spouse in the US. 40% of almost heterosexual relationships now start online, and up to 70% of homosexual marriages. So it has clearly changed the way in which society is built. I think it's probably the most important decision you make in your life, who you end up marrying. And now to meet somebody online. And for me, this is exactly a matching market, because people are assigned all the time And perhaps you are not assigned to whoever you want to be assigned, because that person has to choose you as well. So to me, it resembles very much matching market. And the good thing is that we also have a lot of data. We see the outcome, right? And therefore, we can estimate preferences. And we can estimate, using data from online dating, we can see who tries to reach to whom, how efficient is the outcome of the market, perhaps. It's a bit interesting because the first time I heard this idea that you could think of marriage as market, I was like, no, wait, this is crazy. This is insane. This is
takes all the romance out of it.
It does. It does. It kills all your dreams of being romantic. But once you see the papers and see how well, how aligned the preferences are of men and women, it's crazy. It opens your eyes, perhaps not for the better, but it does.
Yeah, so there's one paper that you've referenced before, this Brook paper, looking at, so you're matching and sort of a competition hypothesis, and they match this hypothesis to maybe to the data to try and see how does the data represent the different hypotheses, and one thing that comes out is the sense of there's a bit of a hierarchy. People know where they are in the hierarchy in the sense of desirability, and you can see that information from the from the online dating data.
Yeah, from online dating and from marriage. But the online dating paper is very interesting, and I'll tell you why. So if you ask in a room to your 300 students, you ask, okay, everybody, who here thinks is smarter than the average person in this room? Around 80% of people will raise their hands. Like, we tend to believe that we're smarter than the average. But surprisingly, when you look at you have very biased beliefs about how smart you are. But surprisingly, yeah, you have very accurate beliefs about how desirable you are in dating. So what the guys in OkCupid do, they construct a desirability index based on, how many messages you are getting and so on. And they rank, from, say, -1 to... And then they look, who are you contacting? So you're contacting somebody that is actually on your league? And you tend to contact somebody that is just above your league, but you are just above. So you are, exactly more or less where you are. Yeah, and we know very interesting things like how much more do you how longer are your messages when you try to reach out of your league, or whether your messages contain more positive words and so on.
Okay. Another example there that you reminded me of is driving. Everybody thinks they're above average driver. And if everybody's above average, then what is the average?
Yes, exactly. Many questions that you ask people tend to have completely inaccurate beliefs about themselves.
Well, I wonder, so the thing about the online dating is that there's a feedback. You're getting feedback the whole time, so you soon learn where you stand, basically. If you're not getting a response, well, then you know where you are in compared to others, I suppose.
The feedback is actually quite brutal, right? Because we know that the Gini coefficient in Tinder is much higher than the one in average economy. 20% of users concentrate 80% of the likes that people give on Tinder.
Let's just delve into that a bit more. So basically, 20% of the users get 80% of the likes. So there's a few people who are getting a lot of attention.
Everybody likes, yeah. And that only means that the remaining 80% of us are only getting 20% of likes. So, yeah.
We have a situation where people are trying to match with each other, and it's a two-sided match. So one partner has preferences and the other partner has preferences, and we need to line these up. And in a case, there's a hypothesis that there's maybe a hierarchy, that some people are more desirable than others, and we sort of know our place in this hierarchy, and we sort of aim for others who are of an equal level of desirability, quantified by, likes on dating sites. But then we sort of reach up. Everybody tries to go for maybe those who are as desirable as us or a little bit more desirable than us. And where we're reaching, you mentioned this, you touched on this, determines our strategy. Our strategy differs depending on who we're reaching in this hierarchy.
If differs very much, and different types of people have very different strategies. So, for example, we know that particular races tend to reply much more than other races. We know that people in the lower end tend to, of course, reply and write longer messages. We know that when you are going to write somebody above your league, you type longer messages, you type messages that contain more positive words. Yeah, it's very interesting to see the strategies. But we know that actually there is a very interesting paper that shows that the outcome of the marriage market looks, or dating site, is the one predicted, very close to the one predicted by Stability. Yeah, it's in the AER, it's in American Economic Review 2010. So it's interesting. Right.
So say that again. So basically, the stable market, in terms of if we're talking about how markets match, and the stable outcome is if what the theory predicts aligns to what the data says in online dating.
Yeah, more or less, you can do that conclusion. And so you know the strategies, you know the outcome. There's quite a lot of data available for researchers there to look at. It does help to understand the. Who gets who marries whom and why? It certainly gives you insights, and I think something I really like about reading papers in this direction is that you learn something for your personal life as well. Like for example, when I was reading the data on OkCupid, they tell you which words you need to write on your first message that you send to somebody to increase the chance that you get a reply. And it's very interesting because the words that you think that you shouldn't send are exactly the ones you know. They confirm your belief. But the ones that words like physics or God or tattoos or dark metal, all these words actually help you in getting and increasing the probability that you get a reply. It's all very interesting.
So words like tattoo and God. Well, they sort of refer to certain type personality types. So basically, if somebody reads this message and it puts a light bulb in their head, they think, okay, this is the person for me. But it's very much it's that you're finding your niche. It's not going to apply to everybody, basically. So is that how it works?
It's exactly that. It's easier reaching out for somebody that has perhaps the same eccentric taste like you. For example, I think that's why online dating is so popular for homosexual people, because perhaps you think there are not as many homosexual partners available, but searching online makes it much easier, right? So perhaps going to a bar, guessing who else might be also homosexual is not that easy. But online, yeah. It's easier. Same, for example, for older people or diverse people. It's much easier to find somebody who is also searching.
Sure. Yeah. It comes back to the whole idea of a thick market versus a thin market, that you have more potential matches in certain subsections of the market, I suppose.
Exactly. So you have thicker pools of people searching, and that general tends to be good because it is easier, and also kind of, perhaps it's a bit a jump from here, but it's also easier to escape from bad relationships, I think. For example, it's well known that when divorce laws are passed and it's easier to divorce or to appeal and these things, we see less cases of domestic violence and so on, because women in abusive relationships or men have, it's easier for them just to find a new relationship or escape. And I think there's no data on this. This is my conjecture. I think online dating will also have a positive effect on that.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point in that, because we don't usually see these relationships, but it makes sense to me in that when it's easier to go to the, when these sort of, what's the word? Buyer's entry or search cost is reduced, well, then you're more likely to maybe move out of a suboptimal allocation. Translate this to an economic jargon.
It's exactly that. And I think
it takes all the romance out of it.
Good. In a sense, it takes all the romance out of it, but it's very interesting. There's this nice paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences a couple of years back, and it shows something that is very unintuitive, is that relationships that start online last just as long or perhaps a bit longer than relationships that start elsewhere. So you think, you know, tend to think of Tinder and online dating apps as perhaps hookups or things for casual encounters. But actually, these relationships that start here are just as good as any other. And also, relationships that start online, they transition towards marriage at a much faster rate than relationships that start elsewhere.
That's really interesting. And is that because they're perhaps a better match in that you've more closely aligned with your preferences?
Perhaps better match, and there's also a self-selection issue, right? For people that are on online dating are quite actively looking, right? So
yeah.
Perhaps these people are more into actually finding a partner.
Okay, sure. And we have to stress here, we're talking an average. We're not talking for everybody.
We're not talking for everybody. No. And there are always deviations, indeed. But the average effect is exactly what I said. These relationships last as long. They reveal higher indices of satisfaction in census questions. You know, people go and ask, how happy are you with your marriage? And transition towards marriage much faster rate. So it's interesting that something as silly as online dating that we do so casually has this big impact in society.
Another interesting point that you brought up there about strategies in when you're on the online dating and like terms of endearment, basically straight off the bat, don't go down as well as
the standard things like babe, love, Connie, all those things like. They don't help, you know, and it's also very interesting to see, and this here I move a little bit into interracial dating. And for example, if you ask on OkCupid, would you strictly prefer to date somebody of your own race? 51% of white women say yes, I have strong preference. And that's just what people are telling, right? Probably the real preference is much higher than that. For example, there are other papers that have found that white women would prefer to date a white male without education than a black man with a degree. And so it's interesting to see all these things, but it's interesting to see that perhaps these outcomes were based just to how we meet our partners in the past. Most common ways were via a friend of a friend, via a neighbor, via in the school. But where cities are very segregated by religion, by race, by income. You know, you tend to, the friends of a friend's probably same religion as yours, same race, same income level, same education level. My neighbors probably have the same income level as me. I mean, we're able to afford a house in this neighborhood and so on and so forth. But suddenly with online dating, with Tinder, you are exposed to anybody 10 miles around. And these people are presented to you somewhat randomly. So suddenly you can reach to people that otherwise would be a complete stranger to you. This is how I started this paper. I was heavily using Tinder when I was in New York, doing part of my PhD in Columbia University. And I was very surprised to see the people I was meeting were so different to me. And then I actually plotted my Facebook friendship and plotted the girlfriends I had in high school and undergrad. And I had lots of friends with these people, but the girls I met on Tinder, you know, I had nothing in common with them in terms of friends and perhaps also in terms of bands, music that we listen to, things that we do, even food that we eat. And so that has consequences that are very important.
Yeah, so basically it's increasing the diversification, essentially, of the pool. And then so that means that we have more diversified matches, I suppose.
It is, because, for example, if you think that the racial preference that we know that people prefer somebody from their own race with few exceptions. But you think, okay, so if your preference were this strong and suddenly you're exposed to other people, that wouldn't change anything because I still prefer, say, to marry a Latina rather than somebody else. But actually, there is a very, very nice paper in the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences called The Limits of Racial Prejudice that shows that when people are exposed, say, I don't reply to Asian Americans. But once I'm exposed to one Asian American, I have a successful interaction. Some chat doesn't need to be a date or anything. Suddenly, I become much more open. And this kind of evidence is all over the place. There's a nice paper, I think, QGE or AER, that shows that communities where they had American soldiers that were probably black became much more open to racial interaction and so on. But it's very interesting that so this mechanism would not do anything of being exposed to other people, would not do anything if your preferences were very strict. But the cool thing is that your preferences are not strict. You change your mind about preferences once you're exposed to new people.
Yeah, so yeah, that's really interesting. So basically, you don't have to... So our preferences are heavily influenced by what we're familiar with, and this helps you become familiar with more things, and therefore your preferences maybe...
Exactly that. You perhaps I say I'm Mexican, never left Mexico, and for me the best food is tacos. But you know, I go abroad and I try steak pie and I love it. No, and it's in a sense based on that. Like you perhaps, for example, you care more about other things like education, like income, and then race is a bit left behind. And it's very interesting because we see very, very, very strong correlations that after internet is enabled and OkCupid and Tinder come to play, the number of interracial marriages changes dramatically. And this is a very sensitive issue because 50 years ago, interracial marriage was still forbidden in 13 out of the 50 states in the U.S. So it's very sensitive, you know, like you could go to prison for this, marrying somebody.
You've done a paper on this, basically, looking exactly like that. And you, I know you sort of half explained it there, but what exactly did you do in your analysis?
Half the paper is theory and half the paper is empirics. And so the theory, I'll start with theory because I really like the model. So basically we did a matching model, just the standard thing. But here we had many different matching models and each of them was, you could think of it as races. And we put them in a graph, and it looks really pretty nice dynamic. And suddenly, we started, and the idea is that you were able to match with somebody from a different gender, but only inside your bubble. You mainly had interracial connections. You basically didn't have any in between races. And suddenly, we started increasing that parameter, the probability that you meet somebody outside your race. And we saw that the number of interracial marriages increased really, 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 really fast. First, because some people were exposed to others, but also because those new links allow that a friend of mine now can meet a friend of a girl I met. And since marrying somebody via friends of friends is the second most common way, you know, the effect is reinforced. So this was a very nice model in which we theoretically, and with the help of simulations, we show that the number of interracial marriages should increase very fast if you increase the probability that you meet people randomly. And that was more or less the takeaway. We show theoretically that for a measure of how good the marriage is, that also increased very fast. And that was the model. And it's a cool model because it has a very nice picture to do it and you can put it in MATLAB. It's very cute. And then the empirics, we try to say, okay, is the model correct? Let's give it a valid prediction. So first thing we did, and I think this is why the paper got so much media attention and sites because... No. I think economists haven't thought about online dating seriously. So what we did is we look at the impact of online dating in interracial marriage. And the first, we just plotted these two things together. And you see a clear different trend after internet starts being a thing. And then you see a clear other trend after Tinder and OkCupid start being a thing.
So you're plotting, is it interracial marriages recorded in certain areas?
You just plot interracial marriage in the U.S. that you can construct from the census over time. And, you know, in 1967, it's basically zero because it's still forbidden in 13 states. And then it starts growing very, very slow. And then suddenly it's a complete change in the slope. And that correlation, it was very, very interesting because why is this happening? So then we'll try to see whether this correlation was actually causation or try to provide more arguments on this. So what we did is to look, we don't have data on how many people are downloading Tinder, right? Actually, you cannot have because, back in the day, we didn't have any number of measure of how many people are using online dating. We know how many people are marrying interracially because the census in the U.S. tells you that very, very clearly. So what we did is we used as a proxy for online dating the number of people with internet access. We think that, of course, clearly you cannot use online dating if you don't have internet access. Therefore, these two things should be very, very highly correlated. And then we look, we downloaded a wide set of controls on education, income, other things that you also affect your decision of marrying. But we look at whether having internet affected the probability that you married interracially 2 or 3 years later. And we found very strong coefficients, like significant, very strong effects, suggesting that there was still a large effect. What we're doing now is, I'll say two more things on this. Now, the papers, we haven't published it yet. We're trying to tackle the concern. You can say, well, the internet availability perhaps is not just exogenous completely. No. Some places like New York are more likely to have more internet than Texas, and perhaps the racial preference changed a lot. So we're using several instrument variables on this to tackle this concern. And since we put that paper online, a couple of sociologists from Stanford and Texas just went asking, like, okay, how did you meet? Are you married? And how did you meet your partner? And is your marriage interracial? Have found that if you met your partner online with the most recent data, probability that your marriage is interracial is you're 7% more likely to be in an interracial marriage, controlling for a wide range of other characteristics.
Like, if, as you said before, you know, your life partner is the most important, one of the most important decisions you'll make in life. And if exposure to different races makes you more open to choosing a life partner of a different race, well, then that's a really strong signal to maybe try and, you know, have more mixing in other ways to try and maybe remove you know, racism in other aspects of society.
You're absolutely right. But it's interesting that, for example, the government has so many programs to try to foster racial integration and other types of integration, you know, integration between religious groups and so on. And in general, it's incredibly hard to achieve, particularly in the most intimate spheres of life, like marriage. And it has been an obstacle. It just didn't happen, you know, from 1960 to 2000, basically, or 1995. And it's curious that something as silly as these things can have such an effect. And it's not really just online dating. It's one thing. So, for example, another thing that we know that has a massive effect on your life outcomes is doing an Erasmus. Suddenly, you're exposed to a completely new world. And we know that if you do an Erasmus, controlling for other things, there's a very nice paper by Matthias Parry that they look at. There is a randomization between who does Erasmus to avoid the self-selection issue. These people are much more likely to marry internationally, much more likely to end up working abroad. And it's just this thing of new connections. In the study of social networks, it's one of the most popular papers ever is by a sociologist called Mark Grundewetter that explained that in many cases, the most important connections in your life are not your close friends or your siblings, but people you don't really know their surnames. He called them weak ties. This is how it's more likely for you to hear about new job offers, to hear about news, to hear about bands that you are going to be super interested in. And this is what was happening for romantic interactions. It was a friend of a friend that was connecting you to your girlfriend, your boyfriend, whatever. But now suddenly we call them in the paper absentees. Suddenly you are just connected to somebody random because pretty much that's what Erasmus does. That's what, not absolutely random, but Tinder does. And this has a massive effect on the structure of society.
That's all I have on my list. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to mention.
I wanted to mention that every time I present this academically, some old professor comes and say, yeah, that's how I met my wife or my second wife. So many of the late weddings I've been to started online. It's amazing. Second thing I want to mention is that my girlfriend, I met her at a party, but then I re-met her online. It's interesting that I study this, the big side of it. Applies to my friends,
yeah,
applies to me.
Yeah, it's something that we can all relate to, I think, in the real world. Okay, well, Josue, thanks a million.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for the interesting questions.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.